This is people.
This is People Like Us with me, Kim Ghattas, a podcast by Project Brazen in partnership with PRX. We're back with another episode connecting the dots between today's Middle East and the world, how it works and why it matters to you wherever you are. Take a step back from the headlines as we explore the trends and themes that bring together people like us everywhere, from Beirut to Dubai to Vegas. No, we're not going gambling. Today, we're diving into the world of poetry, fiction, and translation from Arabic to English. Can literature from the Arab world change perceptions about the region? Can we ever really understand a culture when we don't read its authors? And what nuances do we then miss when we read them in translation? These questions have been on my mind for a long time, and I really enjoyed exploring them in this episode. So be part of the conversation with your friends around the world and connect with us on Twitter and Instagram. We're on @PeopleLikeUsPod. My guests this week are Zeina Hashem Beik, a poet from Lebanon whose bilingual poetry has mesmerized me.
Blue, azraq. نرى البحر ولا نراه إلا في المنام. A patch, a glimpse among the antennas أو من بين الأشرطة على الأسطح.
Then Egyptian novelist Ahmed Naji joins us from Las Vegas, where he is in exile. And finally from Dubai, literary agent Yasmina Jiraisati, who has made it her mission to get more books translated from Arabic into other languages to build that bridge between the Middle East and the world. All this after a short break.
What is actually going on with the economy nowadays? The price of gas? Inflation? Are we in a recession? I'm Jeff Guo, co-host of NPR's Planet Money. Come along with our super team of econ experts as we delve into the stories that show you how the world really works. That's Planet Money from NPR.
Now, there are so many misconceptions and misrepresentations about the Middle East, even when it comes to things like books and how much the region writes or translates. Back in 2002, the UN issued a report which said that the Arab world barely translates around 300 books a year. That's one-fifth of what a country like Greece translates. So it was a shocking number, and it made headlines for years. It's still trotted out regularly, feeding the stereotype. But it turns out it was wrong. It was a guesstimate. More recent on-the-ground research shows that the Arab world has been translating an average of 1,500 works a year over the last two decades. I was discussing all this with Ahmed Naji, whom you'll hear a bit later on, and he told me a surprising fact. It turns out the US actually translates a really low number of books per year, 350, for the same size population as the Arab world, more or less. Which means that in reality, if you're using the correct numbers on both sides, the Arab world today translates four times more books than America. But you know, no one is getting stuck on how much the US translates or not, or what that says about American readers, because the United States produces so much literature in itself, in English. And so many authors around the world write in English. So what we should really be focusing on is how much a country or a region produces in its own language. And the Arab world has such a rich tradition of writing and literature and poetry. And yet here the issue is that so little gets translated from Arabic into English and other languages. And so the world is missing out on this window into the region written about in Arabic. Let's explore all this and go to my first guest. Zeyna Hashem Beik describes herself as an Anglophone Arab poet. She's from Lebanon, but she has always written in English. Her words have been described as powerful, graceful, and defiant. In 2017, she won the May Sarton New Hampshire Poetry Prize for her book, Louder Than Hearts. Her latest publication, O, came out this year, and it's truly a gift. It includes a collection of bilingual poems, as you heard earlier, which she describes as duets. Zeyna recently moved to California. Zeyna Hashem Beik, it's really wonderful to speak to you. I've been mesmerized by your poetry since I discovered it. It's incredibly powerful. It's defiant. It's graceful. You grew up in Lebanon, but you always wrote in English. Why is that? Why did you prefer English to Arabic?
Initially, it wasn't in English. Initially, as a child, I wrote in Arabic and then I wrote in French because I was French educated. English was introduced in sixth grade, so later on.
So English is actually your third language and you're a published poet in English.
Yeah, I didn't start learning it until the age of 12. But I think it's a mixture of post-colonial education and just sheer chance. I think as a child, I loved the Arabic language, but then somewhere along the line, I kind of internalized the notion that I will never be good enough in Arabic. And so it kind of scared me. And I think for many of my Arab speaker friends, they kind of waver between, oh, we hate this language. Why do we speak in a language that we don't speak in our daily life? Or it's the best language. It's a divine language. It shall not be touched. And I think both stances are kind of harmful because you shouldn't hate your own language. And also, you shouldn't deify it. You shouldn't make it into a god, because once you make something into a god, you can no longer talk to it. It becomes like this thing on a pedestal that's not alive.
You mentioned several times that Arabic is difficult. And also, as you say so rightly, it is a beautiful, rich language with a long tradition of poetry across centuries. How do we make Arab poetry more accessible, including in translation? And what are non-Arabic speakers missing?
Oh, that's very difficult to answer. I think in translating poetry is really hard because you've got cadence, you've got nuances in a certain language that don't exist in another. So I think the translator always has to make personal choices that another translator might not make. And so you end up sometimes with same poem, different versions. And really, there is like no right or wrong. How can we make Arab poetry accessible? By translating more of it, but more importantly, by publishing more of it. I think publishing in America is very American-centric. And I think my podcast that I do with the poet Farah Shamma Maqsooda was literally my way of selfishly going back to Arabic poetry and being reintroduced to it. And it was in the least scary way possible, which is like, let's sit with a friend and talk about this.
This intersection of identities and the multiplicity of languages that you speak provides what you described as a bigger playground. It's a wonderful playground of languages and of cultural contexts that you can latch onto, because when you speak the language, you can also instantly understand the context. Is this a smooth intersection of identities, or do you experience it as an ongoing struggle?
I wouldn't describe it as struggle. I always saw it as a kind of richness, to be honest. Am I not lucky to have grown up with three languages, which kind of give me the power to tap into different worldviews, right? So how can we play more?
Yeah, in this playground.
Yeah, and it doesn't mean it's always smooth, because it is difficult, but I like difficulty.
And it allows, in your case, for incredible creativity, because you've created this new form of poetry. It's called a duet, in which you alternate between Arabic and English verses. How did this come about and how does it work?
You've got English and Arabic simultaneously on the page, and Arabic is an equal partner to English, as opposed to what I did before, which was maybe thread an Arabic expression into the English poem, or, you know, that I did that before, but I had never done like, no, the poem is fully bilingual. So Arabic is an equal partner. And the idea is, if you only read English, you have on the left side of the page an English poem. And if you only read Arabic, you have on the right side of the page an Arabic poem. And if you read both, you kind of go crisscrossing across the page. And hopefully a third poem opens up in that conversation between the two languages. And it's hard. It's hard because sometimes it flows in English and it flows in Arabic, but does it flow in when you switch English Arabic? So it kind of takes a lot of like revision and kind of tinkering.
But they flow incredibly well in your latest book. I mean, it's just absolutely wonderful. And I fell in love with one of those duets. And speaking of flow, my favorite one is called Blue, and it's about the Mediterranean. And I'd love you to read some of it for us.
Sure, yes. Blue, أزرق. نرى البحر ولا نراه إلا في المنام. A patch. A glimpse among the antennas أو من بين الأشرطة على الأسطح. How to brave this blue? لا بحر لنا هنا ولا قوة. Sometimes I forget the sea. Is this close? لنا حب قديم يريد أن يحفر لك في الإسمنت شاطئا. My love, I want to dig a beach for you out of this cement.
Give us just a couple more lines.
Okay.
It's just so beautiful.
لنا كأس تجري فينا كنبع صغير ننسج فيه سماء وغروبا ونجوما وتراتيلا. My parents threw me in the sea when I was two, and I floated. They called me little fish. My parents trusted the sea. إلهنا الأزرق لم نعد نعبده وما زلنا نحبه. Oh, blue God, we no longer worship, but still love.
It's incredibly evocative of the Mediterranean Sea, which is obviously on our shores here in Lebanon and for so many countries around the Mediterranean, a sea with which many people have a very conflictual relationship as well because of the refugee crisis and this passageway to Europe, and a sea that we don't see enough of when you're living in Beirut. It's like we're turning our back to it, and that's what the poem is about. You left Lebanon in 2006. You moved to Dubai in the Gulf. You were still in the Middle East. You're still connected to culture here, in a way. Now you've moved all the way to California. And I'm wondering how that changes how you experience writing in totally different surroundings. How are you inspired as you write your poetry?
It might be too early for me to recognize the shift because I'm so new. Like, it's been, 8 months? So I haven't been writing poetry at all. I've been recording my podcast. I've been writing letters to my friend Farah in Arabic, which is strange, but I've been going with that flow. And I've been writing nonfiction. I think nonfiction and essays kind of allow you to think more about that transition that I've just made or that move that I've just made. So I think my mind is kind of trying to make sense of this move across continents by writing in Arabic and by writing in prose. Right now, that's what's happening.
Thank you for your beautiful, powerful poetry. And thank you for reconciling me with poetry. For me, poetry was something I just had to memorize when I was in school, and I forgot about it ever since. And now I'm like, wow, this is actually really beautiful and inspiring and soothing and calming. So thank you for bringing that back into my life. And I hope the many listeners who are listening to this podcast and who will, I hope, look up your work.
Thank you, Kim. I appreciate that. I really do.
I could really sit here for hours just listening to Zeina read poems, but it's time to go to Las Vegas to speak to Ahmed Naji, a novelist and literary critic from Egypt. I first met Ahmed when I was researching my own book, Black Wave, about the Saudi-Iran rivalry, and Ahmed is one of the characters I feature. He had just spent a year in prison, not for expressing his opinion, not for political activism, but for his novel titled Using Life. It's a bit of a sci-fi book imagining the future of Cairo. It has a lot of sexual references, which offended one man who then sued Ahmed for infringing public decency. Despite the dark experience of jail, Ahmed remained his usual self, defiant and irreverent. He received a Pen Award, and his prose has been lauded by fellow author Zadie Smith. After jail, Ahmed was under a travel ban for over a year, and once that was lifted, he left Egypt to join his wife and child in the US. He's in exile now on a fellowship at the Black Mountain Institute in Las Vegas. When I first met you in Cairo in October 2017, you were just out of jail, but still under a travel ban. So I want to go back to that period and talk about the book that landed you in jail, which is titled Using Life in English, in Arabic, Istikhdam al-Hayat. It has a lot of sexual content, references to drugs. You talk about masturbation and pornography. You're subversive, irreverent. It is about politics without being overtly political. It's a serious book as well. What inspired you to write it?
Usually it's something that is built up through time. What I'm always curious to write about is love and friendship. And I usually write about those topics in a science fiction atmosphere. So in Using Life, I was curious to follow how the city, how Cairo itself as a city, could affect the formation of friendship and love story. And I was trying also to imagine an alternative for Cairo, a kind of another future, which back then seems like far away and seems unrealistic. But now we see like most of what I talked about in the novel is happening. In my novel, there was like a sand tsunami, an earthquake, and the city, Cairo itself, was buried under sands. But what we are seeing, what's happening now, that General Sisi is moving the capital to the desert, and he's burying the old city.
You said that in prison, you started believing even more in literature. You didn't always see yourself as a writer, but you decided to become one in jail. Tell us briefly, what was it about the experience of being in jail, in prison, for 300 days that changed you and made you decide, I must be a writer, a full-time writer, a professional writer?
So there was a huge crackdown on media and journalism. And I worked with all my life as a journalist and as a documentary filmmaker. And suddenly it was impossible to shoot a film in the street. They were arresting friends and colleagues. The police will go and do raids on production houses and newspapers. And actually, before entering the prison, my plan and my work plans that I was working on, I was trying to get a license to work as an agent for a belly dancers.
For belly dancers? Wow.
Yes. So this was my plan before the prison for the future.
That's very different than being a writer.
Of course.
Although it's also art.
It is. But like back then, I believed like, well, I'm a writer, so I'm doing this as a secret job or as a secret hobby. I don't know. Like some other writers love to be brave and vocal. I don't. I'm a coward. I don't have the power. I don't belong to any political group or ideology. So I don't have the power to fight against a tank.
Because it's important to point out here that you were thrown in jail for a work of fiction. It's not like you had written a political pamphlet or a political book or a political analysis. You were put on trial for violating public morality with this book.
Exactly. So you start to question it. And when you question it, you start to ask yourself, oh, what should I do when I get out of here? Until one day, there is an event that happened. I was in cell with more than 60 other people.
In one cell with 60 people?
Yes, yes. Most of them, because there was like a media attention to my case, so they put me in like VIB cell. And so most of my cellmate was corrupted judges and high-ranked army officers and high-ranked police officers.
And I remember from reading your book, some cockroaches as well, actual cockroaches,
yes,
right?
Yes.
It wasn't exactly clean, even though it was the VIP
yes,
wing.
Yes, yes. But one day, this guy, I woke up 2 a.m. to enter the toilet, the restroom, and I found him crying. So I went to him and asked, oh, what's up? What's happening? Are you okay? Something happened to your case? Someone hit dangerous? And he's like, no, no, nothing like that, nothing like that. Just, have you read this novel, In My Heart, A Hebrew Girl? I was like, no, I didn't read it. There is this writer who's writing kind of Islamic novels. And I was like, no, I didn't read it. And he was like, oh, you have to. It's amazing. It's beautiful. It's heartbreaking. Like, I had to leave the book on my bed and to come here because every time I look at the cover, I start to cry. And it took me a couple of days until I was like, well, in addition to that, you are a writer. You are here because of writing. And it's better to continue in this path. And it's better to focus only in this path.
So here's a cold-hearted man on the floor of a prison cell in Egypt, crying about an Islamic romance story. And in a way, changes the course of your life and your choices. And you go from being wanting to be a belly dancer agent to being a writer. That's indeed the power of the word, the power of writing and the power of stories. And we're so lucky that you are continuing to write. But I do want to point out to our listeners that one of your cellmates was Ala Abdel Fattah, a British-born Egyptian activist and blogger who's been wrongfully imprisoned for 10 years now and has also written a book in jail, which has also been translated.
I was actually in the same cell with Ala for 4 years, and he's a dear close friend. We have known each other since 2005, and what's happening with him is horrible, unbelievable. But also, Ala again is showing us how resistant can change the dynamic of the power. He's in hunger strike until now, and he chose a path to resist. And in his last visit, when his mother visited him, he even like was losing any hope. And when he's losing any hope, he was like saying, well, now the situation has changed. I'm in hunger strike, not only for me, but all for other people who are in jail because of their political activities or because of cases related to freedom of expression.
When you were in prison, you received a note of support from Salman Rushdie, who was, of course, violently attacked and stabbed on stage in New York in August. Today, you are at Black Mountain Literary Center that is part of the City of Asylum Fellowship that Salman Rushdie helped to inspire and found. Tell us about this sort of worldwide community of writers under threat for writing fiction. And there is this need to find places of shelter in a way for writers who are under attack, like you.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I was disturbed and angry since I hear the news. And I'm happy that lately I'm reading the news that he's recovering. I wish him fast and well recover. I actually, before entering the prison, I only read like 2 books by him, Fury and the Stanic Verses. But my close friend, Ahmed Wael, he would like always insist me and try to suggest that I read his other work. But it was like all of them in Arabic, they are above like 500 pages. And I was like, man, they need a lot of time.
You had time in prison, yeah.
Yeah, and basically my friend Ahmed Waed, he was the one who brought me all of his books.
When you were in jail, he brought you the books.
So I was in the prison. This is where I read for the first time Midnight Children and Shame and Joseph Antoine. And I read like 6 or 5 of his books. And one day while my family is visiting, they told me about the Pinbury Prize, Freedom to Write. And they told me about the letter and the supporting message.
It's a handwritten note from Salman Rushdie.
So it was really, really a beautiful and nice gesture from him. And when I entered the state, I entered by a touristic visa, which allow you for 6 months and it doesn't allow you to work or to do anything. And I couldn't go back to Egypt. So I reached out to Pan-American and asked them for any way to help me at least to settle this situation with visa. And they put me in touch with BMI and their city asylum fellowship.
The Black Mountain Institute, yeah.
And I learned so much from him. I learned so much from him because City of Asylum program, it started in 1993. Like the first time he talked about it was in the Writer Congress in 1993. And back then, there was a wave of killing Algerian writers. Okay. So the program first, actually, it started to support and to rescue Algerian writers from Al-Qaeda and Chinese writers. This was after the fatwa. There was like a state, an official state, who was trying to get his help, and they still try. But he was thinking about other writers.
That's incredible that while he was still in hiding, he was in hiding for about 10 years or living very low profile after the fatwa by Ayatollah Ali Khomeini came out, basically calling for his death. It is incredible, as you said, that he was thinking of how to help others who were also facing similar threats. And the 90s were very difficult in the region, as you said, for Algerian writers, for Chinese, and also for Egyptian writers. Several of them were killed. And that's when Nobel Prize laureate for literature Naguib Mahfouz also faced an assassination attempt in Egypt. Thank you for sharing your journey as a writer, as a former inmate, you know, having spent time in jail in Egypt, and finding now a different kind of freedom to write and be translated in the US, in Vegas, of all places, as you also find yourself on a journey as a writer and discovering your identity in the US. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you for having me, Kim.
Are you an author from the Arab world trying to be translated into English? Which books and poems from the region have you read and which have made an impact on you? Or are you an author from anywhere in the world wondering about the power and shortcomings of translation to reach new audiences? Tell us more by sending us an email or a voice note through our website, www.peoplelikeuspod.com. Next up, I'll be talking to literary agent Yasmina Jreisati, and we'll be back after a short break.
Douglas Latchford was the premier expert on Khmer art.
The art was his thing, Cambodian art.
Over the course of several decades, Douglas Latchford carried out the sustained and systematic theft of some of the most exquisite art in human history.
Latchford really plundered this entire civilization.
Search and follow Dynamite Doug wherever you get your podcasts. It's a production of Project Brazen and PRX.
This is the greatest art heist in history.
Yasmina Jreisati has made it her mission to get more books translated from Arabic into English and into other languages. Yasmina's uncle is a famous Lebanese novelist, Ilyas Khoury, and his books have been translated into many languages around the world. Yasmina herself was dipping her toes into the world of publishing when the attacks of 9/11 happened, and she was in New York at the time. The horror of that moment is still with us to this day. But so is some of the stereotyping and prejudice against people from the Middle East. Yasmina felt this was something that perhaps she could tackle with literature, bringing down barriers one book at a time. It hasn't been easy. Yasmina Jreisati, thank you very much for joining us. You have a PhD in color cognition. But in 2004, you set up a literary agency representing Arabic writers, writers from the Arab world writing in Arabic to get them translated and read by the rest of the world. What is that gap that there is there, the barrier to entry, if you will, for Arabic literature getting published in other languages? Now, I think it's often easier in French because of France's colonial past in the region, but into English, it's not that widespread still.
So first of all, there is a first barrier of language for sure. Now, English is a special case because English being the language today because of this whole predominance of the US, like everybody wants to buy American literature and they sell tons and they buy very little. Anyway, it's a very small market when it comes to buying. Like I think in comparison a few years ago, I haven't checked this number in a while, but just to give an example, like I think the Netherlands had a number like 30% of their production is translated fiction, whereas in the US, it's 3%. So this just tells you, you know, how much they're buying. And so within this 3%, how much space is there for Arabic literature? I mean, you're competing against French literature and Dutch literature and Swedish literature and Japanese literature. So it's a very tough competition on top of the fact that Arabic is not very known. But I think there's another more complex kind of obstacle, which is the whole like geopolitical baggage. So you mentioned earlier, you know, maybe France is particular because there is this very long colonial past and relationship. But in fact, I'm not always sure it plays in our favor.
Why is that? Is it the Orientalist approach to the region that sort of skews what they're interested in and what they want to read?
Yeah, this is one thing. But in our case, there's also with more contemporary history, the immigration issues in France and all of that, there is certainly also a sense of we know everything we need to know, or we are tired of these questions. So it's a kind of a complicated relationship. So some editors who were interested in Arabic literature are trying to fight that. Like, no, there's so much more. Let's make these books known. But then the readers is a different story. So it's complicated.
And that takes us back a little bit to the point you made about how you felt being in New York in the aftermath of 9/11 and the sort of the gap that grew between this region and the rest of the world and how it's misunderstood and often miscast. So how does literature help in overcoming some of these stereotypes or barriers?
Literature has a lot to teach when it comes to other parts of the world because you're identifying to a character. And so you empathize with the emotions, with the situations. And so you learn at a different level. So you might not be learning objective facts, but suddenly you have a tiny piece of that experience that the character that you're identifying to is living. And so I think literature can tell you a lot about a place, about what people are going through. And so what I felt like being in New York after 9/11, I just realized that people like us, and I mean by us, like the ordinary moderates, not the extremists on any side, like most people actually, so like us, are just have no voice. Because we are moderate, you're not heard, because you're not making yourself heard. And so I felt like too much attention was given to the extremes. And so I felt if literature could reach people, there are a lot of ifs there, of course. If there was more of it translated, if there was more of it published, if more of it was read, then maybe there'll be less prejudice, less misinformation, less ignorance, and therefore less conflict and less wars. Of course, literature can change the world.
Aspirational, yeah. But it's fantastic because actually you use the term people like us, which is the name of the podcast, and trying to get over these stereotypes and trying to give a voice to the large majority of moderates, as opposed to the tiny minority of extremists that have grabbed the headlines, is precisely what we're trying to do. And whether it's a podcast or whether it's literature, it's just fantastic to speak to like-minded people. And there's so many writers out there, and some of them are part of this episode, who are being read now and translated. There are still obstacles, because you set up your agency in 2004, and it was a while until you had your big break. I think 8 years, in fact. And it came with a writer from Syria, Khalid Khalifa, and his novel, In Praise of Pain, which is set in the 1980s in Syria. Tell us a little bit more about the novel and why it took so long to get a break.
Yeah, so it took a long time. It could be a mix of things. It could be me learning the trade as well. There's a lot of luck. So I didn't get, I think, the right book early enough. I didn't see it. Now I see it immediately. Like international editors, they need like a hook or something that can basically help them market the book, sell the book, or pitch the book. And I didn't know what should be. And In Praise of Hatred by Khalid Khalifa definitely had that.
And so tell us about In Praise of Hatred. What was it about this book that attracted publishers and translators?
So Saleh Khalifa is a very powerful storyteller. So he's extremely textured and dense, and his characters are very alive, and he has a lot of subplots. And so it kind of creates this world where you get immersed. And all of this is set, in this case, in the context of the Hama massacres, which nobody had ever written about.
The 1982 massacres in Hama by the Syrian regime at the time, led by President Hafez al-Assad, which killed thousands of people.
Exactly. And so this was the historical context in which he chose to set his novel. And so I think he managed, and Khalid, I think, does manage to give the reader this sense of travel, where you feel like you're in this place that's so different from yours. And it's very sensual in the sense where you get like these smells and these colors. It's because it's very textured, very rich. But at the same time, he's not satisfying this exotic thing. He's giving you something else. So he's able to kind of play with this appetite for something different, but at the same time, provide you with high quality literature, and the depth of the topic in it and what it gives you is information.
What is the primary audience of your writers? Are they looking to write for a Western public, or are they primarily first writing in Arabic for readers in the Arab world?
No, definitely primarily writing for readers in the Arab world. And I think these are the books that have most sincerity to them, because I'm attracted, and I think these are the most interesting, personally, it's my taste, to books that I can feel they express something that's very close to the author's heart. I've been approached by younger writers who come to me, and I can see immediately that they write addressing to a foreign audience. And I find these books usually, in my experience, again, I might be wrong, but what I've seen, it tends to be less interesting. People who live like you in your conditions, they're the ones who need to know what you're saying, what you're feeling, the stories you have to tell. And then if there's an extra relevance for people besides or beyond this region, which is closer to you, then yes, you go to translation. But the shortcut doesn't work, because it's not interesting to a foreign audience. You know, if it's not interesting for your local audience, then it's not interesting for an international audience. For example, I remember a very young author from Kuwait. He had written his book in English, in fact, and he was writing about homosexuality. And so, you know, he figured this topic would be of interest abroad. And so it was very clear that he was trying to explain his way of life and his struggle. And so although I think it's an interesting topic, I don't think it was developed in an interesting way.
You have a lot of Syrian authors, Khalid Khalifa, of course,
yes.
Khalid Ismail, whom you just mentioned, and Samar Yazbek.
Yes.
What has the world missed until you came along to get all these incredible Syrian authors into translation?
I can't take all the credit, but thank you. I don't know. Something certainly happened also recently. I mean, when I first started in 2004, Samar Yazbek had already started writing, and she was definitely an interesting voice. But now she's grown. I mean, as an author, her voice is so much more powerful. And actually, her newest novel is also on my new list, and I'm very excited about it. It's called Maqam al-Riyah in Arabic, or The Wings Abode. It will be published by World Editions at some point. So yes, I think there was just also an explosion of talent in Syria around 2005, 2010. And I think that the Syrian revolution kind of suddenly put a spotlight on these people. So it was a break for them as well, that we were able to use other voices. Like Dima Wanous had a beautiful book as well. And she had a beautiful book as well. So I hope she'll keep on writing. I'm sure she is. So she also got a break, but not as big yet, because she came later in the wave of the Syrian war, whereas Khalid and Samar had already written before. So it's a question of timing as well. And there are many more that I just cannot represent, because I have to be super selective, and I cannot represent too many authors dealing with the same topics, because then I can't sell them.
So many hours in the day, of course, as well, to do all this, because there is an incredible amount of talent in this region, and the traditions of literature and poetry in the Arab world are long and well known. Yasmina Jadaisati, thank you so much for opening up our eyes to the world of Arabic literature in translation, and we look forward to reading some of your authors.
Thank you very much. I was very happy to be here.
You can read more about all of Yasmina's authors on her website, which we link to on our own podcast website, www.peoplelikeuspod.com. Please do also pick up the book Written in Prison by Egyptian-British blogger and political activist Ala Abdel Fattah. Ala has been unjustly detained for 6 years. He and Ahmed Naji, my guest, are close friends, and they were cellmates while Ahmed was in jail. Alaa's book, You Have Not Yet Been Defeated, was written mostly in prison, smuggled out, and translated into English. For our next episode, we're switching gears a bit, focusing on just one interview, exploring American foreign policy in the Middle East, how it works or doesn't, and who are the fallible human beings behind the policies and what drives them. So stay tuned. If you enjoyed this episode, share it with your friends and family wherever they are in the world and tell us your story by sending us an email. We're on people@peoplelikeuspod.com or send us a voice note through our website. You can also send us questions about the Middle East or American foreign policy or suggestions for future topics. I will answer as many as I can in a bonus episode at the end of the season. For now, thank you for listening and join us next week. People Like Us is brought to you by Project Brazen and PRX. Executive producers Jane Beresford, Bradley Hope, and Tom Wright. Research and production Farah Baba. Social media Noor Abdel Latif. Designed by Jamal Saleh and original music by Haig Papazian. Sound engineer Luka Djordjevic. People. 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 People.